Welcome to the Minor Consult, where I speak with leaders shaping our world in diverse ways. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by the legendary musician Paul Simon. Over an eclectic career spanning six decades, Paul has written, recorded, and performed some of America's most iconic hits. And he's been honored with countless awards for musical achievement. He's also an active philanthropist and health advocate. Paul co-founded the Children's Health Fund in 1987 and graciously supports our Stanford Initiative to cure hearing loss. His most recent album, Seven Psalms, was released last year to rave reviews. Paul, welcome to the Minor Consult. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, Paul, let's start with your roots. Over the course of many decades, you've delighted audiences across generations with your poetic writing, memorable songs, and inspired performances. Thinking back, what drew you to music in the first place, and what's kept you inspired over the course of 20 albums?
Well, I think my first real interest in music. Well, first of all, my father was a musician,
right.
So I was aware of the music that he played and that was of his era, which was the big band era. I wasn't interested in it, but that doesn't mean that I didn't hear it. I heard it. The first music that I really liked was early rock and roll. And there were so many different styles that in retrospect, I could describe it as world music, which is something that they used to say about my music when I was working on Graceland. And by that description referring to the music of the 50s. If you're talking about the doo-wop vocal groups that I listened to, because I grew up in New York. So New York was one of the places where vocal groups were common in all the boroughs. So it really was true that people stood around under street lamp on the corner and sang in harmony at night. And that was true for a lot of different cities along the East Coast. Philadelphia had a Boston, and Los Angeles had a doo-wop world. New Orleans had one. There was that kind of music, and that was essentially urban vocal music. Then you take the music that came out of Louisiana, like Fats Domino. That's out of New Orleans, and there's a certain rhythm to it. New Orleans music is an inheritor of the African diaspora with the drum.
Yes.
So you get the drum leaving West Africa, going to Brazil, coming up through the Caribbean, entering into the Gulf and into Louisiana. So you get a certain kind of syncopation and rhythm in that kind of music. I was very drawn to that. So all these different cultures are being thrown together and being played for the first time on one radio station, and they call it rock and roll.
Yeah,
it's really world music. So without me being conscious of it, I was listening to a lot of different cultures that I liked. And I think in later years, when I said, oh, I'd like to record in Jamaica, or I'd like to record with South African musicians, or I'd like to record with Brazilian, I was hearing sounds that I heard when I was very young. I think for most people, maybe it starts younger now, but I think for most people, somewhere between the age of 11 and 15 or 16 is when you fall in love with your music.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a crucial thing. Before that, where memory is a bit more of a mist than adolescence, it's what you heard that somehow you fell in love with. Maybe your mother sang a song to you before you went to sleep. Maybe you heard melodies in church, or maybe you might hear a melody in a Seder. And that has some effect upon you. You're not conscious of it. And for most people, they needn't be conscious of it. But for musicians, at a certain point, you wonder, why do I love this sound? Why am I drawn to the sound? I really don't know the answer to why, but I do know that the sources come from varied cultures that had all become American culture, and they called it rock and roll.
That's amazing. And Paul, your most recent album, Seven Psalms, is a departure from a standard record. It's one piece lasting 33 minutes and seven movements, and predominantly you and your guitar. Can you tell us what inspired this approach and this piece?
I guess the main thing that happened that became part of the story of Seven Psalms is I had a dream on the 15th of January, 2019, and the dream said, you are supposed to write a piece called Seven Psalms, or you are writing a piece called Seven Psalms. And it was a very strong, it was a very impactful dream. I woke up and I wrote it down. And then, maybe 8 or 9 months after I had the initial dream, I started getting dreams 3 or 4 times a week, between 3 and 5 a.m., and they had lines in them. They had words in them.
Ah.
So I would get up, because I noticed, well, this seems to always happen every time I, you know, get up and leave the bedroom and wander into another room. I see, oh, it's 3:15 in the morning. So I'd start to write down whatever it was that came in the dream. And if I thought, well, that's an interesting thought, I'll go and write a second verse could be. And as soon as I went to that thought, as soon as I went to craft, everything stopped. So I said, okay, this is a gift. I'll just collect this because that's all I have. That's all that's required of me. I'm not making it up. It's just coming to me. I'm just taking dictation. And that's really how the piece evolved into something that I could see was going to be a completed piece called Seven Psalms. And I thought, well, this is one of the most pleasurable and easy things that's ever happened to me.
Okay.
Then my hearing loss began.
Yes.
And that was very distracting at first. I mean, and has remained distracting and or more since. But I was very, very annoyed at the hearing loss, which at that point was just a diminished hearing. It wasn't a complete loss, which it is now. But then I started to think, you know, maybe all of these easy guitar pieces and easy lines out of a dream and all of this, maybe that was like the first part. And the hearing is something that needs to be incorporated somehow into what I'm writing. Maybe this is not an obstruction. Maybe this is an element that should be used. And I began to do that. And those are the components. I played guitar and I wrote rather more complex guitar pieces than usual because I had plenty of time, and my facility got better because I was playing 3-4 hours a day. And then when I started to record it, I added sometimes other guitars to fill it out, but mostly I became very interested in percussion instruments. I'll show you what I mean. Hold on a second.
Sure.
Like some of these guys that I'll show you, and I've become a collector of percussion instruments now that I'm interested in it, and people know that I'm interested in it. So
okay, they send you percussion instruments.
They do, yeah. My band members do. But I would take
that's great.
Something like this.
Yep.
And once the sound got somewhere around here, I would record it, and I would add it to a guitar part,
yeah,
so that the overtones of the strings,
sure,
took on a bell-like quality, and I would use different bells for different sounds.
Yep.
All of these things to magnify the overtones and the implication, the rhythmic implications of what the guitar does, because the guitar is really like the whole orchestra. This is an instrument from Asia, from Vietnam, I think. I don't know if you can see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes I stick this underneath a guitar note and you use it like...
Yeah.
And that was just one of many. I would use a glockenspiel that I have, sometimes some huge gongs, or a lot of instruments to make the guitar piece feel like it had depth. And it felt like it had a depth that was not coming from Pro Tools or the computer. It was coming from an acoustic sound, and it created, I think it created a unique sound on a record, because it's essentially an acoustic guitar record.
So, Paul, I know your hearing loss has persisted, and how has it impacted your life and your ability to write music, play instruments, and perform?
It has had a very significant effect on my life. It requires a lot more energy to be in a conversation now. I have to really concentrate on what people are saying. I'm not having that problem with you, because one-on-one,
sure,
is okay. But if I'm at a dinner table with six people, I really can't hear a lot of what's going on, so it's frustrating on that level, and it's tiring on another level. In terms of writing, it doesn't affect me that much because the guitar is sitting close to my ear, so. I can hear that fine.
Okay.
In terms of playing with other musicians, that's the big problem.
Yes.
I can't play with drums or electric guitar because the sound is too much and it's confusing, and I can't put my voice into the mix in a way that makes me want to be musical and sing, because I'm struggling too hard just to make sense of the elements. If the music, if the instrumentation is softer, like Seven Psalms, I have a chance that I can do that. I rehearsed Seven Psalms from start to finish with the full ensemble, and I was able to do it. Seated, I have to be seated to do it because when I'm standing, the difference between the sound that I'm hearing from a speaker and my ear is instead of it being this close,
Sure. Right.
it's that close, and it's that distance, and that's enough for me not to be able to hear clearly. So I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to perform this publicly, but I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to do it. I have rehearsals in September and October to see, I'm not sure.
Well, I know I speak for all of us listening and saying we certainly hope it works out. And what you've described about the hearing loss, about it, if its effects on your life, it's unfortunately so common among
Yes,
people
it
with hearing
is.
loss, and something that I, as an otolaryngologist, have had interest in for years. And here at Stanford, you've been very gracious in helping us with our Stanford Initiative to Cure Hearing Loss. And this initiative brings together 100 scientists from around the world to study what causes hearing loss and to find ways to repair or prevent the damage that results in hearing loss. You've been a great help to us in talking about the initiative, talking about the effects of hearing loss on your life. Can you tell us why the cause resonates with you on a broad scale, and what progress do you hope to see in the coming years?
Well, the reason that it appeals to me is obvious. I suffer from hearing loss, and the hearing aids that I use, they came through a recommendation from Rob Jackler at Stanford, and so that's how I met people at Stanford, and then a few months later, I got a text saying, would you be interested in having a meeting with some scientists and hear what we're up to? Yeah, I was. So I came out to Palo Alto and listened to what was the work that was in progress, and it was very exciting. I thought, I mean, this could be great for me. And also, if I can be of help, of course, I'm glad to be of help. I would
Thank
be
you.
happy to. The first thing that happened was I was doing a Stephen Colbert show, and he has hearing loss. We began to talk about it a bit. And as you know, and probably a lot of people know, it's pretty common.
Yes.
The hearing loss is very common. So there was a reaction to that discussion. Then I came out, and you were gracious enough to allow us to use your house and talk to people from your community, and tell them what the Stanford Initiative to Cure Hearing Loss was hoping to achieve and was working on. And then Anthony Mason, who has a show on CBS, he became very interested in it and wanted to do a show about Sichel, which will happen n next month, and in October, which will come out to Stanford and show the laboratories and talk to the scientists. So It's very interesting for me. I was very interested just to be in a lab, you know, to where cutting edge work is being done, just to see what the equipment is,
sure,
who the people are, and talk to them, and talk to people who were scientists, and that was fascinating. And I hope that that the CBS show will achieve the same thing. I'm sure it will. So that's you know, that's how I got involved, and as much as I can contribute in the future, I will.
Well, Paul, it means so much that you are, and I have to say that evening at our home was certainly one of the most memorable events in my life, my wife's life, and for those who joined us there, and for everyone here who has had the privilege of meeting you and sharing their science with you and seeing your engagement, your interest, there's just absolutely nothing more inspiring and rewarding. So on behalf of all of us here at Stanford...
It's been a very pleasurable experience, but the hope is that bringing together teams from the science world, the investor world, the philanthropic world, bringing together some really smart, the world of show business, bringing all of this together to make a team that can amplify the work that you're doing, that's doable. And that would be an achievement that would literally help billions of people. So that's my hope.
Paul, thank you so much. And I want to end with two questions that I ask all my guests. First, what do you think are the most important qualities for a leader today?
Well, that is a seemingly compact, easy question, but actually it can... seems to me it contains several questions. What quality do you... the first thing I think of it is that what qualities are necessary to produce the most good in the context of the times that the leader is functioning? So from 1943 to 1945 in Great Britain, while Germany was taking over Europe, you have Winston Churchill, who has the quality of "we will never give up," and can literally put his nation on his shoulders and carry it through. The same could be said for FDR in the Depression with. Nothing to fear. If you need somebody like that. These qualities quite often, although not all the time, quite often contain the element of charisma, which is incredibly overrated.
Simply
a factor that makes people want to watch or look at you. It's neither good nor bad. It depends upon what it's mixed with. So if it's mixed with Jesus or Nelson Mandela, it produces a certain kind of following. If it's mixed with Hitler, it produces a terrible thing. So charisma is in there, but it's sort of no importance. What's of importance is what does the society need, and the leader who is volunteering their services, do they have that quality to lead? And as the times change, that quality may not be needed, and it may be time for another leader. To go to like my youth with Kennedy, with John Kennedy, he had enormous charisma. And after the assassination, Lyndon Johnson, who did not have that charisma. He was the person who was the right leader to achieve all of those civil rights.
Yes.
All of those civil rights amendments. When that was passed and the Vietnam War became the main issue, he was the wrong leader. So there, it's hard to answer the question of what the right leader is. It depends on the context, I think.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And my second question is, what gives you hope for the future?
Well, that's another easy question to ask, but I would ask you, how far in the future are you talking about? My life, my kids' life, their kids' life, 500 years, how far in the future?
Yeah, well, let's talk about your life and what gives you the hope. You're still doing incredibly creative things. You've made a challenge and a really unfortunate event, that is the loss of hearing in your left ear, left hearing loss. Rather than detracting from your talents, you've looked at it as an opportunity to focus on different aspects of your talents, and you're still doing really creative work. And I'm just curious that you have to be a person who has a lot of hope and a lot of optimism for the future. And how do you package that?
I'm also a person that has quite a bit of pessimism about it too. So
okay.
it's a balance.
Okay.
I think I generally would fall in the category of optimist, but putting my personal issue aside, I mean, what would my hope be? My hope would be that my hearing would
sure.
return, you know, but, I hope that we can find a way of learning from nature how not to do the damage that we're doing, but more observations of nature.
Sure.
Because as things become less hospitable to our species on the planet, there's a drive to change nature to compensate for it. That makes me nervous. On the one hand, it's our great quality that we have these brains that can do this amazing stuff. On the other hand, we're really pretty stupid, you know, as a species, and not a particularly good example. In fact, maybe the worst example of species on the planet. We're like the only species that if you took us out of the whole picture, everything would get better. You know? So, I mean, if I was not a particular member of that team, I would not be rooting for this particular species. But I am rooting for the species.
Good.
So I hope that we'll be able to... I guess the easier hope is that as we discover more about the body and how it works, we can alleviate suffering and make life richer. So that would be in my lifetime and my kids.
That's wonderful.
That's what I would hope for.
That's wonderful, Paul. And Paul, thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you for listening to The Minor Consult with me, Stanford School of Medicine Dean Lloyd Minor. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion with the legendary musician Paul Simon. Please send your questions by email to theminorconsult@theminorconsult.com and check out our website, theminorconsult.com, for updates, episodes, and more. To get the latest episodes of The Minor Consult, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate the podcast 5 stars. Your feedback helps make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to our next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and be kind.